The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Sports Talk 1240 is brought to you by DraftPot.com. DraftPot is changing fantasy sports. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with promo code SportsTalk1240 and receive a 100% deposit bonus. And now, Sports Talk 1240.
One down, one more to go here, Sports Talk 1240, live on your radio dial, AM 1240 WGBB.com, and over the airwaves here on Long Island, Sports Talk 1240. Nice way to kick off this very, hopefully soon to be beautiful, month of March the 6th, here this evening. Ukwa Sonye, Raymond Mora in the studio for the next hour. I wish there was change, but it's just the hour. Brian Graves on the one and ones and twos on the other side of the board. Big show for you today. We've got Patrick Stevens from D1 Escorts at 9:15 before Eric Boland from Newsday joins us at 9:40. Of course, you can always call in 631-888-8811. But I asked Ray to fall back for a couple minutes because it's very tough to watch professional basketball in the state of New York nowadays, because certain things about some team in orange and blue that doesn't play at Citi Field really just kind of messes with me. It really makes me feel a certain type of way. And it really started, I believe it was about Wednesday, when a fan was heckling Carmelo Anthony, who said, "Hey, look at the owner," who then had the gall, yes, I said the gall, to go back and tell his star player, "You need to go and apologize." Except Carmelo Anthony was absolutely right. Now, don't get me wrong. I've got my own issues. I've got my bones to pick with Carmelo Anthony, the basketball player. We know he thrives in isolation, which stops the ball. We know that sometimes he's a bit lackadaisical on the rebounding and defensive end. But let's face it, he's still a top 20 NBA player. And a top 20 NBA player actually needs pieces around him. And the one time that they gave him a somewhat decent team, the Knicks won 50 games and fell to an Indiana Pacers team that pushed the Miami Heat, the soon-to-be Eastern Conference champions. So I find it very difficult to sit and watch this team because it's clear that something's not right. And the worst part about it is they did enough in the offseason where they shouldn't be this bad. They did enough so that you said, okay, they're finally building towards something. And then Derek Fisher, before he rightfully got fired, came sideways out of his mouth to say that we're a rebuilding team. So with Robin Lopez on the wrong side of his 20s, with Aaron Aflalo, who's been on at least three NBA teams, last time he was in Portland, where they barely, you know, couldn't quite get it done in terms of what they planned to do with LaMarcus Aldridge and Robin Lopez, might I add. You traded Tim Hardaway Jr., a deal I still love, but he's now thriving with the Hawks, for a first-round draft pick point guard whom you barely use. What the hell are you doing? It makes no sense. And then you have games like Friday against the Celtics. You think, oh, wow, the Knicks might turn a corner. The Knicks might at least finish with some pride, and obviously not. How they then rebounded to beat the Pistons, soon to be 8th seed by double digits, I will never understand, and you can't make me understand. But you also cannot, it can't be said enough. I don't know what's happening in Madison Square Garden, but it's not worth the time anymore. It's not worth the struggle, because all it does, whenever you turn it on, it just makes you upset. Because if Carmelo doesn't take a shot, oh, he's not being aggressive enough. If he does take a shot and misses, oh, he's being a ball hog. And the more I think about it, from watching him play over the years, he is the offensive option on the floor. He is. Without Kristaps Porzingis, who doesn't get the ball where he's supposed to have the time anyway, he's the best option on the floor. So Carmelo Anthony driving into traffic beats a fallaway post-up back jumper, whatever the hell Aaron Aflalo calls himself doing. Carmelo Anthony taking a contested 15-footer. Sometimes he'll beat Robin Lopez on a pick-and-roll. And Carmelo Anthony, spotting up for a three-pointer, will beat him kicking it out for Jose Calderon to then pass to somebody else who'll brick a three-pointer. It's a travesty. It's annoying. I'm sick of it. End the doggone season already. End it. I'm done. I'm through. I don't care anymore. New York basketball as a whole, at least on the lower part of the state, is just disappointing. The imposters from Brooklyn are getting exposed. Good for them. Poor St. John's couldn't even get a win in conference play. And I know it's a big rebuilding year for the Red Storm, but good God almighty. New York big scene basketball, as you would call it, is just atrocious. It's bad. It's awful. And frankly, nothing merits paying attention to anymore. Not at all. Which is why you got to give it up for the mid-major schools. Yes, sir. I know we have a few colleagues at Sports Talk 1240 who are excited about the Hofstra Pride, whom we will be talking to, Patrick Stevens, within just a moment. But, right, I told you I just needed some time to get some stuff off my chest. I mean, go. Just go. That's what the Knicks have done to this show. Blame the Knicks for this haphazard start to the show today.
Well, you know, the funny part is they're only six games back. Besides all of this, they're still six games
back.
That's not only
anymore, though. They've got a month left. That's not only anymore.
And pretty much their death sentence is probably the West Coast trip, which they're going to go on soon. But looking at it from all this, you know, you look at the Knicks, you look at it basically a film that you watch over and over again. You already know what's going to happen in the beginning. You know what's going to happen in the middle. And you certainly know what's going to happen at the end. It's always been the common theme for the Knicks for this past season. They play good, then at the end, they gave the game away. It's been like that for the past couple of games. Yes, they had a win against the Pistons, but come on, they're the Pistons, okay? They may have some upgraded their team in terms of the moves that they made, but they're the Pistons. They beat them twice already at home. Now Melo's arguing with ref fans. You see teammates getting frustrated with each other. Lopez screaming at everybody, telling, you know, he's frustrated with what the team is right now. I mean, look at the team right now. They should have been a playoff team. They should have been an eighth seed. But looking at this roster, I mean, you got Lopez, you got Aaron Aflalo, you got Lou Amundsen, who doesn't even play a lot. You got a rookie and a point guard who's probably better at Calderon athletically, but not in terms of running the team. And then you have, Carmelo, who's playing whatever he is. And Porzingis is just, he's Porzingis right now. You know, he has his double-doubles, and he has games where he's struggling. He's a rookie. But, you know, looking at all of that, the Knicks, all they got to do right now is just ask them all this question. Where are they heading in terms of the future? Because you have a president who's probably not going to be there for the next year. Or we don't know that for sure. Maybe he's going to be out there. But I think this team right now, they just got to keep fighting and see what happens. And that's all you can do. And they need to get more versatile players, which is important.
Like I said, pro basketball in New York is just a waste. It's a waste. Like I said, this is what college is for. And particularly where New York is concerned, at least the lower part of the state, that's where the mid-majors come to play. And then you also have South Orange, New Jersey, and Syracuse, New York. But to cover all of that, we welcome in Patrick Stevens. And now, Patrick Stevens, first of all, a lengthy resume with the Washington Times, USA Today, recently did a college football update for Syracuse.com, runs his own site, D1Scourse.com. Patrick, I probably butchered that. Can you tell me the right way to say your website's name as you join us tonight?
Discourse. It's basically kind of got, it's sort of like the movie Seven, except you have D1 and it's all that, and yeah, it confuses everybody. I probably should.
See, at least I have the man himself to clear it up. Patrick Stevens from Discourse.com. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. And first things first, if you paid attention to college basketball in any way, shape, or form in 2013, not just because of realignment as a whole, there was one guy not named Joe Lunardi that picked the 68 teams to get into the NCAA tournament, and he's on the line right now. Patrick, how did you do that?
Just a lot of studying and a lot of time invested and just kind of figuring out the committee's track record and trying to follow it and apply that same logic And some years that works, and some years like last season it doesn't work, and they throw some curveballs and show that that different things are valued. So there's certain things over the years that the committee consistently places an emphasis on, things like high-level quality road victories as good things and poor non-conference strength of schedules as bad things. So you look at those sorts of things and you just try to do your best and study as much as you can and parse and look things over and hope in the end that you're right.
And hoping certainly worked. What does your preliminary look for this season? Are there a couple teams that people aren't paying attention to, ignoring, you know, the OVCs of the world where number 8 seed Austin Peay took the championship, but are there any bubble teams that people are really not paying attention to that you would tell them to look out for?
I think that whoever winds up losing in the West Coast Conference, whether it's St. Mary's or Gonzaga, is going to be kind of one of the weirder teams right on the edge of the field. Neither one of them, Gonzaga or St. Mary's, has a victory over a top 50 team, but both of them have some decent things about their profiles otherwise. You know, Gonzaga hasn't lost to anybody outside the top 100 and has won a ton of road games. St. Mary's has done reasonably well on the road as well. They do have the two victories over Gonzaga already, and so those could sort of inadvertently, if they lose to Gonzaga in a potential West Coast Conference title game, might wind up giving them top 50 victories if Gonzaga is able to leap into the top 50. That's sort of how weird that can be at times. So that's a team to keep an eye on. And I think another team that's kind of lurking around out there, I'm not sure they can get enough traction at the ACC tournament this week, but their profile isn't as irrelevant as probably a lot of people would think, and that's Georgia Tech. A team that just beat Pittsburgh and made Pittsburgh's life a lot more difficult this weekend. The Yellow Jackets have been playing well down the stretch. They'll face Clemson to open up the conference tournament. Then they'll play Virginia if they get that game. And so suddenly you would have a team that might look kind of a borderline tournament type team. I'm not sure they can quite get there, but I do think that's a team that's a lot more relevant than people would assume.
Hey, Patrick, it's Raymond here. I wanted to ask you about, you know, Duke this year because, you know, they started off really slow. Now they're, you know, building up some wins right now. They're in the rankings right now. Is that a team that any team should be dangerous with, even besides of, you know, the situation this year where any of the teams could actually win the whole thing?
Yeah, I think Duke is quite good. I think the question with Duke is going to be, you know, do they get themselves into a game that's tightly officiated? Because if you're trotting out what amounts to about a 6.5-man rotation, you're going to be really, really susceptible to foul trouble. So that's something that they can't have happen. And also, if they just run into some team that's deep that can just throw wave after wave at them, I think they're going to have trouble too. I do think that anytime you're looking at a team that has somebody like a Brandon Ingram, a Grayson Allen, guys like that, it's not that there isn't talent there. It's not that they can't beat people. The question is whether they can actually string together victories. Now, the good thing for them is that they demonstrated really over the last month to 6 weeks or so that they can beat good teams, and that was something they really hadn't done for the first month without Emile Jefferson. So, you know, for them, it's obviously not a situation where they're wondering whether they're going to be in the field or not. They're probably looking at being somewhere in that 4-seed range, maybe a line lower than that. But I do think that they are more susceptible than a typical Duke team is to a lot of things. And it would be very impressive for that Duke team to make it to the second weekend of the tournament.
What's your take on Ohio State this year?
Going to have to win a lot of games in Indianapolis. And I'm not sure that they're capable of doing that to make the tournament. An Ohio State team that kind of got caught reloading a little bit and just didn't quite have enough working in its favor. Yeah, they're 11-7 in the Big Ten, but when you look at what they've really done, they beat Kentucky on a neutral floor, they beat Iowa at home, and they beat Michigan, and that's the entirety of their top 100 victories. They're 3-10 actually, again 3-9. I'm sorry, against the top 100. Just not a team that's really accomplished a whole lot, and that's not even getting into some of the games that they lost early in the season. Sometimes you get caught without some pieces that you need, and I think that's what happened to Ohio State. Although I do think that they're a team that could win a few games in the NIT if given the opportunity.
So what's your take on the Ben Simmons situation with them, well, pretty much the fans screaming out his undergrad GPA, you know, performance not being eligible for the award? Is that something that fans should be addressed, you know, pretty much attacking him in terms of what he is? Because, you know, he's a gifted player, and we know what he can do as a playmaker and all that, but is that something that fans should do?
Look, here's the thing with a guy like Ben Simmons, who clearly has drawn plenty of attention for where he's ultimately going to go in the NBA draft. At this stage, the only reason a guy like that is in school is because he isn't allowed to go into the NBA at a certain age. Now, obviously, if he chose to, he could play. He could play in Europe if he wanted to. He could play in the D League if he wanted to. But at the same time, I think some of this is simply set up. The system sort of sets up some of these things for guys that maybe just don't want to be in school. Maybe they're just not interested in being in school. You know, it comes down to a really basic idea. School's not for everybody. You know, and I think we all knew people growing up that, you know, had abilities, but maybe just weren't all that interested in class. And it happens. And, you know, I think that doesn't, that's not something worth yelling and screaming over. And certainly, you know, it's hard to really pin that on colleges, when the system is essentially being set up at the pro level. So I think the disdain should probably be directed in that direction. As opposed to any university.
We're talking to Patrick Stephen from Discourse.com. And if you joined us earlier, you'll know that's spelled D1SCOURSE.com. That same D1SCOURSE, well, that's a mouthful. That's also his handle on Twitter, and you can follow all of his analysis of pretty much everything going on in college basketball. Let's look a little bit local here. Hofstra's finally headed to their first CAA championship game since 06, and they had a near miss last year. Can you tell me a little bit about how really Hofstra's made its way back? They haven't really been this relevant since 06, and then the 01 team with Speedy Claxton.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, you know, that this Hofstra team has turned it around as quickly as it has under Joe Mihalik. You know, just a couple of years ago when the CAA tournament first came to Baltimore, Hofstra was playing UNC Wilmington in the 8-9 game before about 30 people on Friday night. It was the only game that night. There was just nobody in the building. And here we are a couple years later, and they're playing on Championship Monday. Obviously, a guy like Awanye Green, who followed Mihalik from Niagara, a really big key to this. Hofstra's a really good offensive team, not particularly deep, and I think that's really one of the big concerns. You look at the game today, I think a big key for the Pride, Amin Tanksley really taking advantage of some opportunities as William & Mary threw a lot of its defensive attentiveness at really trying to contain Green. And as a result, Tanksley had some good opportunities to get to the bucket. And you look at some other guys they got. Gustis is a phenomenal rebounder, really one of the fun guys to watch play. Bernardi's a guy that can hit a lot of threes for them. But like I said, depth is a bit of an issue for these guys playing three games in 3 days. And they're facing a UNC Willing team tomorrow that quite frankly, has kind of found another gear at the start of the second half, both of the last two nights. And I think that has to be a really significant concern for Hofstra. Can they withstand that sort of push that is almost certainly going to come at some point tomorrow?
Let's look a little bit out eastward for Stony Brook. And now Stony Brook's had such an interesting postseason story. Regular season champs four times in the America East, but they haven't really been able to push on and sort of make their way to the dance. And tomorrow they have Hartford at home, tip off at 7 p.m. What has really fueled them this year, including the play of Jameel Warney?
Yeah, I mean, for Stony Brook, it begins with Warney. I mean, I think you can make a case, if you're making a list of guys, that even if you don't have a rooting interest in a particular team, that you hope in some ways get the chance to play in the NCAA tournament. A guy like Warney that's done so much, a fantastic rebounder, a phenomenal scorer, and really kind of an underrated passer as well, is one of those guys that you kind of hope gets that opportunity. But the reality is that he's not a one-man band. With Walker and Purifoy, that's a really, really good team. The sort of team that, quite frankly, number one, it's clearly better than anybody else in that conference. certainly compared to the rest of the country. But also a team that's very capable of at least throwing a scare, if not beating a really, really good team like a 4 seed or a 3 seed after the brackets are announced next week. So I think for Stony Brook, a team really gets to play at home this round, would get to play at home in a potential championship game. The ball's in their court, and quite frankly, there's no Albany around to ruin things for them now either. So I think this is clearly as good an opportunity for all of the chances that Stony Brook's had. This is probably the best one yet.
And they'll finally get a chance to go to the dance, I believe, for the first time in school history. Let's go out of state and look at a really great story out of the Big East. That's not St. John's. In fact, it's Seton Hall. And between Isaiah Whitehead and Desi Rodriguez and even Derek Gordon, the UMass transfer, how different has this program looked with their head coach Kevin Willard at the helm versus the Bobby Gonzalez years?
Well, I mean, I think you can even make the comparison between this year and last year. I think Willard's done a fantastic job of kind of reinventing things on the fly just in the last year. And I think watching them at this time last year when they were completely self-destructing, and you wondered at the time, does Willard even return? Obviously he did, and was able really to, even with some attrition and whatnot, to really get everybody on the same page. And I think they're a fantastic fantastic team, safely in the tournament field, I think, at this point. You look at what they've done since the tail end of January. Besides the two losses to Butler, they've pretty much handled their business. And I think, to answer your question, clearly you're talking about somebody in Kevin Willard that's a very different sort of person than Bobby Gonzalez. I don't see there being a giant cloud over that program. And some of that is obviously dissipated just in the last year. But I do think Seton Hall in great shape at this point, and it'll be a very significant landmark for them to get back to the tournament for the first time in a decade.
Last question for you, Patrick, before we let you go. I have to make this one homer question. I'm a George Washington guy. I know they suffered a bad one to Davidson on Saturday, which was kind of meaningless, but still, it's a game you'd like to have back. Is there any scenario short of a championship game appearance that gets them in the tournament?
I think they absolutely have to make it to Sunday in Brooklyn, and they may even have to win the whole thing at this stage. If you're George Washington, that was a loss. That was a game you really couldn't afford to lose. It set you back a little bit. And quite frankly, they're not going to gain anything from that first game that they play there. And so if you're the Colonials, you got to make a deep run. And frankly, we're talking about teams that have depth issues. George Washington, really, really shallow, particularly in the front court. I'm not so sure they're built to make a long, deep, sustained run in the conference tournament. And I think that was that was made a lot more difficult for them. I think they might have had some hope of maybe being able to pull it off, just making the semifinals, but it's going to take a little bit more now with that Davidson loss.
Well, I definitely had to ask. Patrick Stevens, once again, from Discourse.com. That's DISCOURSE.com. Use that same and apply it to his Twitter handle. Patrick, thank you so much for your time, and enjoy the rest of your night.
Yeah, enjoy the night.
Thanks for having me, fellas.
Not a problem. Again, Patrick Stevens, one of the better college basketball writers in the nation, in my personal opinion. He's always been great, chronicles stuff with such great detail. So it was nice to have him on. Before we go to break, do we have a chance to go to break? You know what? Let's just go to break. We'll come back. We'll go back into baseball this time around because it's spring training time. Let's talk about the Yankees and the Mets, and Eric Boland will join us on the other side of this break. Sports Talk 1240. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB. Be sure and visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Hey, fantasy sports fans. DraftPod has an exclusive offer for Sports Talk 1240 listeners. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit. That's right. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit. What are you waiting for? Do it now.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gustbuster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your GustBuster today.
Whether you're a couple enjoying a romantic meal for two, a family wanting to dine in a relaxed and friendly setting, or a larger party wanting to celebrate a special occasion, Miller Place Pastoria always combines a warm welcome with the finest contemporary Italian cuisine and wines. Also serving up Long Island's favorite pizza. We're located right on Route 25A in Miller Place. Come visit us today and check us out online at mppastoria.com.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
Unquasonye, Raymond Mora, right here on our West Babylon Studios, WGBB 1240 AM. Eric Boland, the Yankees beat reporter from Newsday, will be joining us in about 10 minutes or so, but first we have to talk about the Mets, because for some reason, and I understand that it's a really wide divide between the layman, people in the media, and the professional athlete, but apparently so much was made about Yoenis Cespedes trotting out his different rides to spring training. My question to you is, why don't you just get money? It's totally... an improper, there's no real way, unless you play Major League Baseball, to get $25 million a year. But, I mean, if you got it, you got it. Let the man roll in whatever sort of car he wants. The fact that the man has enough money to have a three-wheeled car, I don't know the proper automotive term for it. Do not quote me on it. I won't care if you try to. Let the man live. Now, $7,000 on a pig, well, I don't know really what to make about that, but he earned his money. Without him, you don't get to the World Series, so y'all can kind of lay off a little bit. But I think the funny thing is Ray, we were talking during the break, you have sort of a bold prediction, which to me makes sense, and we'll go into that a little bit.
Well, this is a bold thing to all Mets fans, and I hope you don't hate me, but I don't care because I'm a Yankee fan, and I don't care. I'm just being straightforward about it.
Out of the gate, you're just being antagonistic. out of the gate.
Straightforward about it. Oh, and I don't care how you Mets fans feel, but this is the truth. Oh. They are right when I play more than 125 games, okay? That spine, that discomfort that he had during the World Series, will continue to be for the rest of his career, which is why he's been throwing side throws to the first baseman. And you got to understand something. The way that they got to look at their right, they got to moderate in the way where he can't be healthy. He's probably going to play some – of course, he's going to play some DH when he faces AL for sure. But I don't think he's going to play that many games in terms of fielding the ball, because they got to be careful. And they got a great pitching staff and all that, but that's just the way I feel. It is what it is.
You know what the funny thing is? I feel like a bunch of Mets fans would actually agree with you with that diagnosis.
Well, because maybe the realistic ones, but not the ones that you're really hyped about their team.
Easy. Every fan base has its zealots. Let's keep it 100. But I think the interesting thing with David Wright, and this kind of goes to my thoughts about not re-signing Daniel Murphy, it made sense why they would let him go, you know, because he had a postseason for the ages, but his regular season is mediocre. His regular season, I wouldn't call it mediocre. That's a little harsh, but it's not worth the kind of money that they would have had to put on the table for him this day.
Yeah.
But with that being said, his ability to play third base, ironically, it made them such a better defensive team. In fact, I was even hoping, you know, before I looked at all the contract numbers, you could do a Murphy right corner situation, but Murphy would play third and David Wright would play first, and it would seemingly work, and you would be able to keep David Wright healthy enough for maybe 125 games. But you got Lucas Duda's contract up there. Lucas Duda's contract, excuse me. You have his contract over at first base, and we already know Lucas Duda can't play the outfield. And between an outfield that will now boast Granderson, Cespedes, and a combination of Lagares and Conforto, and I'll tell you what, Michael Conforto is going to have all eyes on him, because it's great to be a prospect coming up in the middle of a pennant race, because it seems like when you get a big hit, it feels like, oh man, you're going to fit in, but Conforto's had eyes on him from the very, very beginning, and I think he's going to win a starting job. I think he'll win the starting left field job right out of the gate, out of spring training. I think it's going to be really interesting to see how his adjustment period is. I mean, one thing that's always worked for him is his plate discipline is superb, which really makes him an asset no matter where you put him in the lineup. I don't think he'll hit 3-hole right out of the gate, but maybe he'll be in the sixth spot for a little bit. Again, that's all bland generalizations, but the Mets, they could very well be a problem. Now, one thing, Raymond, I'm going to ask you, because it seems to me, and I'm being really honest here, that their middle infield didn't really, it doesn't really move me. You know, Neil Walker, solid pickup.
He's all right.
But he's not the switch hitter you think he'd be. If only for defense, that's what makes him an upgrade over Daniel Murphy. And Asdrubal Cabrera over at shortstop, it's because he's a great fielder that, you know, I think it's a decent move. But I'm still trying to figure out when Wilmer Flores is actually going to get a chance to play it out. Because he was never really a shortstop, but he had to play his way into becoming a shortstop. At the very least, I would have liked to see him try and win a job outright, but it's just really loaded for him right now.
Well, you know, it's a difficult situation for the team because they got Flores, they got Cabrera, they got Walker. I mean, the way it's going to be, it's going to be depending on matchups. And, you know, MLB is all about matchups, who are they facing. They're facing a speedy team, they're facing a heavy hitter team. You know, they're going to need fielding regardless because that's how you're going to win games. And the reason why they lost in the World Series last year is because they didn't have the defense to stop the Kansas City Royals from stealing almost every time they're on base.
Oh, and boy.
I guess they feel like that they do this trade, and then they have Flores there. They have a chance to compete with them and compete with the other team that's pretty much a speedster team, because the Mets' defense last year, they weren't great at all, and that's probably why they did it.
Which is why the deals for Walker and Cabrera really do make sense. But another thing that's kind of wowed me about the Mets, and I get that the ceiling is very high for DeGrom, for Harvey,
yep,
and for Mats, and for Syndergaard, but I have people that are really just kind of going nuts, already comparing them to the threesome of Maddux, Glavine, and Smoltz.
We gotta relax.
Talking about how they're going to be the best foursome in all of baseball. It's like, first and foremost, they just gone through 1 year together. 1 year. Not even a full year. This is the first full year we'll see of them. And you still have Steven Matz, and you still have Zach Wheeler coming back from Tommy John surgery in July. Somebody may get flipped. I'd actually be very interested to see who. But can we relax?
It's 1 year, and they haven't even won a World Series yet, so we can't put them in that discussion yet. Until they win a World Series, until they do something together as a team, I don't want to hear about them being the greatest team of all time or the greatest pitching staff of all time until they win something.
Because that's
just, you know, that's bad.
Being pragmatic works every now and again. I promise. We're going to switch gears, going to talk about the Bronx Bombers. And to help us talk about the Bronx Bombers, the Yankees beat reporter from Newsday, that's Eric Boland. Eric, it's Unquan Raymond. Good evening. How you doing?
I'm doing well, guys. How are you tonight?
Great. Thanks for taking a moment from your time at Yankee camp to join us. I'll ask you, first of all, after the Yankees at least made it to the wild card game last season, do you feel sort of a difference in the way they approach camp this time around versus last year?
You know, not particularly. I mean, I don't think most people with the Yankees looked at last year as a successful season. Yes, they made the playoffs, but, you know, Yankees really keep score based on World Series. And even though George Steinbrenner isn't running things anymore, obviously, he's been gone since 2010, and it was always World Series or bust with him. You know, they're still, you don't see a lot of celebration because they got to the one-and-done wild card game and lost. If nothing else, and Alex Rodriguez said it the day that he showed up, with the rest of the position players, you know, if nothing else, it made them hungrier going into this season.
Well, we got a quick little montage of really, it's only been a couple weeks for the Yankees in spring training, but this is what we've got so far.
There's the 0-2. Struck him out swinging splitter. Tanaka ready to deal. And does. Struck him out swinging splitter. So, Tanaka pitches out of trouble. The pitch to Mateo is in the air to left field. Back goes Bosch. Way back. That ball is gone. How do you like that? Jorge Mateo homers over the left center field wall. Pretty impressive. Whoa. The pitch is cut on. And into the air to right and deep. That ball is going to be gone. Oh, here comes the judge. Aaron Judge goes the opposite way. Think of Yankee Stadium now. A three-run home run to right.
The call is courtesy of John Sterling from the Yankees Radio Network, WFAN. And the reason we played that a little bit, because you saw, Eric, you saw the two kids playing in Mateo and Judge. We know the depth chart sort of stacked against them, but how have they impressed so far?
Well, they're at two different points of their development, obviously. I mean, Mateo probably is going to start the season with Class A Tampa. That's where he ended last year, and he really only got 21 games under his belt with them. So his development, you know, he at the earliest, it would be, you know, big league ready perhaps 2 years. Aaron Judge is knocking on the door. I mean, I think that you're going to see him get a lot of playing time this spring, you know, a handful of games in. You've already seen him out there, and you're going to see him a lot more as the spring rolls along. And the reality is look, the Yankees starting outfield with Jacoby Ellsbury at center and Brett Gardner at left and Carlos Beltran at right, all of these guys have, in the last few seasons, you know, injury history. And so at some point, I would imagine one of them is going to go down. At some point, maybe all three of them for varying points during the year, maybe nothing serious, but, you know, a two-week stint here and there on the DL. And, you know, if it's Beltran at some point, I think there's a, you know, a pretty good chance that, you know, you'll see Aaron Judge as the first guy up that that would replace him. Obviously, if it's Ellsbury, you're gonna get a center fielder, and Aaron Judge is not a center fielder. But, you know, Judge is, he's right there. And, you know, he struggled a little bit last year when he made it to AAA. A lot of that was you just could not adjust the pitching. There's much better pitching in AAA than people think. But he was terrific in AA, and you know, most people at the Yankees feel that, you know, he'll be just fine. He'll start the season with Scranton. And again, when the need arises, and it usually does at some point, he'll be ready. Mateo, you know, again, he'll start the season in single A, and maybe if he has a meteoric rise this year, he finishes the year in triple A. But there's still a decent amount of seasoning to be done with him. He's also only just 20 years old, but certainly – all the tools are there, and when you listen to opposing team scouts that, you know, followed the Yankees just four or five games into the spring, he is one of the guys that they've been raving about.
Eric, it's Raymond here. I want to ask you about the pitching staff right now, because there's two pitchers that I'm concerned with right now, and it's Tanaka and Sabathia. Now, I know what Soriano can be this year. Hopefully he can be going up to being an ace for the team, and hopefully Nathan Eovaldi comes back and he is what he is last year. But those two pitchers, are they the key for the Yankees to be successful with the bullpen that they have?
You know, Ray, I think all of them are, and I know that sounds like a cop-out of sorts, but, you know, if you look at the starting rotation, all of those guys have questions of some kind. And four of the five, it has to do with injuries. The one who doesn't fall into that category is Luis Severino, who is all but certain to make the rotation coming out of spring training. But his career is all of 11 starts old, at least at the major league level. So anybody that feels that he's a sure thing, you know, is probably getting a little bit ahead of themselves. Everything looks good. There is nothing not to like. When he came up last August and pitched as well as he did. But again, you know, you do have to throw the brakes on a little bit and say, okay, we're still only talking about 11 big league starts. The rest of those guys all have some kind of injury question. Nathan Eovaldi got hurt at the end of last season. CeCe Sabathia's troubling right knee has been well documented each of the last three seasons. He's had all sorts of troubles. Michael Pineda, of course, with the shoulder.
Yeah.
Tanaka with the elbow. So all of these guys really have some questions about them. So, you know, when you say are Sabathia and Tanaka the two keys, I think you could throw all of those guys into the mix, because I think if any one of them goes down, you know, you do have a guy in Ivan Nova who's had some success at the big league level. So, you know, he certainly would be a prime fill-in candidate. But then after Nova, it drops off pretty significantly in terms of options for the rotation. So I'm not sure that this rotation can really afford a long-term injury to any of those frontline guys, and certainly two of the ones that you mentioned in Sabathia and Tanaka. But I don't think any of them going down for a long period of time, you know, would bode very well.
Can we expect the same production from A-Rod that we did last season?
To expect it, I'm not sure, but if anyone could do it, it would probably be Alex Rodriguez. I mean, look, he has said it himself that last year was a Cinderella season for him. And when he says he didn't know what to expect going into last year, I'm sure he was more confident in himself than he let on. But I also believe him when he says he had no idea what to expect, because it was pretty unprecedented for a guy his age to be coming off basically a year and a half off. He had the season-long suspension, but he really only played half of the previous season, and it was the first half. And then injuries got him. And so the fact that he was able to do what he did and leading the team in home runs with 33 in a season that he turned 40 coming off of what he came off of, which was a season and a half of not playing, really was nothing short of remarkable. To expect that again this year for a player that turns 41 on July 27th, I don't think the numbers will be quite that good, but, you know, look, he certainly adjusted to life as a full-time DH. He looks in great shape. I know it's a cliche this year, this time of year to say that about just about everyone who comes into camp. He's moving reasonably well. He looks good in the batting cage. He looked good in his first couple of games at the plate. And again, you know, not every pitcher is throwing 95, 96, 97 at this point, but he looks pretty good. If he stays healthy, I don't think a 20 home run season or a tad more than that is out of the question by any stretch.
I'm talking to Eric Boland from Newsday, the Yankees beat reporting. Follow him on Twitter at eboland11. Eric, speaking of the offense, Starlin Castro adjusting to a new position into the AL, but he's had some pretty big hits. Obviously, it's early in the spring, but how has his adjustment really looked in your eyes?
You know, he's looked very good. He's looked good in the field, made a couple of nice stops on some ground balls, turned a couple of double plays. So far at the plate, he's got a hit in each of the first three games that he's played in. And, you know, he hasn't been a major story from the standpoint that he appears to be struggling. I mean, he really has not been journalists who cover the team, you're kind of looking for a, quote, story of the day. To carry you through, particularly before the game start and then obviously after the game start. But, really he has not been, in a negative sense, one of those stories of the day where, you know, new guy comes to the Yankees and appears to be struggling. You haven't seen that. Obviously, there's plenty of time for those to come, but he really seems like he's fit in seamlessly so far.
Now, speaking of another new acquisition, the Aroldis Chapman suspension handed down from Major League Baseball just last week. I know the the Yankees probably haven't said much about it, but do you see it really having an impact as far as the clubhouse is concerned? We already know that when you have the hardest throw in Major League Baseball history not on your team for the first 30 games, your bullpen's going to lose a little bit of firepower. But do you see really much of an effect? How is he interacting with his teammates?
He's interacting great. And you know, I use the phrase seamless transition with Castro, and I would say the same thing with Chapman. I mean, you see him at his locker every day. You see him talking to guys. He doesn't speak English, but you know, you do see him interacting with his teammates, and he's there. He's a presence. He's not hiding in the back. He's available if, you know, members of the media want to talk to him. Obviously, there's a language barrier there, but there's a translator in the clubhouse, and you know, there's certain things that you know he hasn't really talked about or has been limited in what he can talk about when the investigation is still going on. But in terms of him being in the clubhouse and being around his teammates, you see him talking a lot. You see him smiling a lot. And, you know, you see him interacting like any other player would with his teammates. And so, you know, there hasn't been any issues there, certainly none that I've seen or anybody else has seen. And insofar as them surviving the first month of the season without him, look, I think one of the things that has been forgotten about the Yankees from last year, as everyone has been excited about adding Chapman to the bullpen, and obviously there's a lot of reasons to be excited to add a guy like that who throws 102 on a regular basis as your closer, but I think something that's been forgotten is how good the Yankees bullpen was last year at the back end. You know, the Yankees were 66-3 last year when they had the lead after six innings, and that improved to 73-2 after eight innings. So, you know, this was a team that was pretty darn good already in the late innings, and most of those guys, except for Justin Wilson, you know, are still there. And then, of course, meaning Andrew Miller, who was the closer last year, who was set up primarily by Dylan Betances. You've got Chase and Shreve, who a lot of people, you know, again, forget that for the first 5 months of last season, he was as good as any reliever in baseball, let alone any Yankee reliever, any reliever in baseball. And then in the last 3 weeks, he wasn't very good, maybe ran out of gas. But, you know, there's a lot of good arms in that bullpen, starting with the two that I mentioned at the back end. I think Shreve will have a bounce back. I don't even want to call it a bounce back year because he was so good for the first 5 months last year. But, you know, I think his bullpen will be just fine with Chapman out for the first month. And then when he gets back, you know, you're adding strength to strength, I think.
So circling back to Chapman, since he put out the statement regarding the suspension, he hasn't really said much about it, correct?
No, he talked to us the day after. He sent out the statement, and then he held court with the press the following morning and reiterated some of the things that he said in the statement. But, you know, addressed those questions, addressed why, you know, he decided not to appeal. And basically it's just about getting ready for May 9th when he's eligible to come back from the suspension list.
I guess I asked you this question. Yankees have, on paper, probably the best bullpen in the league. They have a solid rotation. Hopefully there's no injuries coming up. They have a questionable offense based on production they had last year and then fading into the end of the season before facing the Astros in the wild card. How many wins can you expect from this team, realistically?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And I was not very high on this team last year going into the season. I picked them in Newsday, I think I picked them to win 78 or 79 games. It was one of those two, and they obviously outperformed that and won 87 and made the wild card. I think this team is better than last year's team, but I also think that, you know, it's a tough division. It's not a great division, but I think every team is solid in the division. I think you can make an argument why every team in the division could possibly win it. And so, you know, the Yankees are obviously in that mix, but, you know, gun to head, you asked me how many wins for this team this year, I would probably say 88, 89, somewhere in that range, with the caveat that, you know, at the trade deadline, Brian Cashman usually does something. The last year there really wasn't the significant moves last year came internally when Severino and Greg Bird came up, but we saw that they both had major contributions. But as the roster is currently constituted, I think I would, you know, I would set 88 at the target number. At least that's my feeling.
All right. Well, thank you, Eric, for being on the show. Hopefully we'll be in contact about the season, and hopefully the Yankees win some games.
Eric, before we let you go, because I don't know why Raymond thought he was just going to step over me on my own show. how about the job that Joe Girardi has done as the skipper? I think I've said personally a couple times that he was robbed of a couple Manager of the Year awards, and these were years when the Yankees really didn't make the playoffs, but still went through injuries and finished over 500. I mean, has he been a little underappreciated as Yankee skipper, or is this sort of run of the mill for him?
Well, I think he has been underappreciated, and you know, I think you know part of that is the fact that you know he really does not try to engender much goodwill with the media. I mean, his relationship is very professional and, you know, with the people that cover him, but he's not warm. He's not the warm uncle storyteller that Joe Torre was. And that's not an insult to Torre. It's just they're different personalities. And so, you know, you don't see him get pushed for those awards the way maybe a Torre would have. But, you know, I think that plays into it a little bit. But I think more than anything, it just has to do with the team that he's managing. And, you know, and Joe Torre certainly ran into this all the time. How many Manager of the Year awards did he win with the Yankees? He didn't win any because the expectations are always high with the Yankees. And Manager of the Year almost always goes to a manager whose team overperformed the expectations that were set in the preseason for that team. And because the expectations are almost always high for the Yankees, and it doesn't always mean that those expectations are informed expectations, but they're almost always high, and so therefore it's difficult to surpass those expectations. So, yes, I agree with you. You know, one of the best managing jobs that was done in baseball probably in the last 10 years was 2 years ago by Girardi when they went into with all the injuries that they had, both as position players and four out of their five starters at some point, you know, going down, and that's actually happened each of the last 2 years, but it was exceptionally bad two seasons ago, and they missed the playoffs by a couple of games, but they went into the last week still in the wild card hunt. That was a tremendous managing job. I mean, if you look at the lineups that were getting thrown out there much of the second half of the season, the fact that they won as many games as they did, you know, was a testament in large part, not entirely, but in large part to Girardi. So to answer your question, I don't think that he gets the credit that he deserves, but that's par for the course for managing the New York Yankees. It didn't happen with Joe Torre, and you know it certainly has not happened with Joe Girardi. Again, it's very rare for you know a Yankee manager to get credit for his team surpassing expectations because they're always sky high going into any given season.
Eric, thank you so much for your time. Enjoy the rest of camp, and hopefully we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, I look forward to it, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much. That was Eric Boland, Yankees beat reporter from Newsday. We're out of time, but we'd like to thank him for coming on. Also, Patrick Stevens from Discourse.com, Brian Graves, our producer in studio, Raymond Mora, my ever so noble co-host, even though don't you ever try to one-up me getting rid of a guest on my own show. Nevertheless, I'm Unkwa Sunga. Thank you so much for joining us. Sports Talk, 1240 a.m. this March the 6th. We'll see you in a few weeks.
Did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.